So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, very briefly, the rules of War Games. Two teams will battle in War Games, which will consist of seven periods. The first period will last 5 minutes. All other periods will be 2 minutes in length. One man from each team will enter the war zone for the first period. At the end of the first period, the referee will flip a coin. The team that wins the coin toss gains the advantage by sending a second team member into the war zone for a two-on-one situation and maintains that advantage throughout war games. At the conclusion of the second period, the disadvantaged team sends their second man in, evening the matchup with 2-2. After the third period, the team which won the coin toss sends their third man in, thus regaining the advantage. The teams alternate during the remaining periods until all 10 men are in the war zone. At that point, the match beyond begins. The only way to win the match beyond is to force a member of the opposing team to submit or surrender. There will be no pinfalls. There will be no countouts. There will be no disqualifications. Official time will be kept at ringside, and the head referee's ruling will be final.
It is review away. Welcome everybody to the program. My name is John Pollock, alongside my co-host, audio engineer, and overall great person, Wei Ting.
Not much of an audio engineer. We were about to record, and John was just. We were talking about. Oh man, sometimes you know, as much as we rely on Levelator, which is a program for balancing audio, we should really try to, you know, make it as good as we can before relying on just, you know, easy technology. So I guess after 5 years of doing these podcasts, we're actually thinking a little about sound quality.
Yeah, instead of just, imagine back in the day where we would just maybe talked into a tape recorder or something.
I don't know if people would have done that.
Send out our shows. You can direct mail order. We'll send you a cassette.
Didn't you have a show? Were you talking to a tape recorder?
No, I had a microphone.
Jaws?
Even way back then, I had a microphone. One of those little plastic mics that you would hook into your computer.
You don't talk enough about
You don't talk about your history either.
I
guess we'll talk about it plenty in 2 weeks on the anniversary.
All right,
right?
Fine.
Of course.
Fine. Oh, we should do another open question thing.
Yeah, let's do that on the anniversary one. I always like doing that once a year. Once a year, we'll talk about non-things to do with an event.
That's just completely kind of
self-indulgent. Yeah. Be very complimentary towards us, how we've changed your lives, how much we're a part of your everyday. We just love to stroke our egos with your words.
Of course.
You know, I have while I'm thinking about this now, did you ever used to make mixtapes when you were a kid?
That was my thing.
I made a lot of them too.
Yeah.
How did you record songs?
Okay.
Did you do it directly off the radio? Because I had some weird ways I did it.
I definitely did that. And I guess this really shows our age, the fact that we even had
I was thinking about this over the weekend of how I used to make mixtapes, and man, I felt like a fossil.
The fact that we even had cassette decks. But yeah, I used to have like a little stereo. It was like sort of my first stereo that obviously had a radio on it and two tape decks. And I would wait for my favorite song to come on the radio and, you know, you just hit record. So I had a tape that captured. So this would be like sort of like my capturing tape. And then I would take that tape and transfer it to like the good copy tape where I like.
Where you'd have like
like
a boombox or something that had two decks.
Yeah. So I'd wait for the song to come on, and I'd take my like capturing tape and just record it with like sort of like loose ends, you know, like the DJ will be introducing it, and I'll just quickly hit record.
Tarzan Dan,
no,
the top seven at seven.
Okay, whatever. And then
AM 640.
So he'd talk into, you know, or at least into the song, and then I'd record a bit out of it too. But then like I would put that deck inside the other deck to transfer it to my good copy tape, so that I would cut off the ends. You know what I mean? But so yeah, I did that for a long time, even before like CDs and MP3s became a thing. I even like we eventually got a system that was hooked up to my TV. So I would record like music videos and then re-record it into my cassette deck to get the songs that way.
You hook up your TV to a – how would you
It was a hi-fi. It was like a hi-fi system with a cassette deck attached
to it. Wow.
Yeah.
See, now I also had – I did very similar to that where I would just tape stuff off the radio and then I'd have the two-deck – deal to transfer it over to whatever I'd have in my Walkman.
Because we didn't give a shit about quality.
No, I just want the damn song and just to hear it on demand when I wanted to. But then when I got the internet, I did not have a CD burner for a long time. So, you know, I started...
A burner. Yeah, well, nobody calls
I wonder how many people we are alienating with this discussion
CD
of technology
burner.
That isn't all that old.
Nobody even burns CDs anymore.
So what I would do, I would download music, and then to get it onto my cassette, because I was still using a cassette at the time, I would put my boombox or whatever up to my speaker and press play and record and then just have like my songs that it would record, and I'd have it in just like not shuffle mode, but I'd have all my songs. So one would go right into the other, tape onto the cassette, and then this would get screwed up because you'd have to time it out right on the tape. And then if the phone rang, fucked.
Oh, you're fucked.
So I'd sometimes unhook the phone.
Or if your mom calls you.
If someone calls down to me. Usually I'd wait for people to go out and I had the house to myself to make my mixtape, where I'd literally be putting it as close as I could to the speaker without it distorting and it would pick it up. Like no cable, nothing. It was just like recording like sound off a speaker.
I suppose today it would be the equivalent of like holding your cell phone to the TV screen to get like a video capture. For like, let's say, oh, this thing on TV I saw was Beyonce performing. It's really funny. It showed her daughter. I'm gonna take a photo of that on my camera of the TV, and I'm gonna upload it to Vine or whatever.
I do that all the time, actually.
Oh, do you?
If I'm watching Raw and I see something funny, I want to tweet. I just take a picture of the TV screen.
It's convenient
TV screen.
And it's immediate. But this is funny because I mean, I did that for music, and I took it like it was an obsession of mine. Like I would even like draw pictures on like I would draw my own album art.
Oh, really? I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, I was a big. Anyway, it was very sad.
What kind of stuff were you listening to? All over the place? Were you into a specific genre?
I mean,
high school years.
Yeah, I suppose it was just kind of like more like rock, you know. Like when I was young, it was probably like just top 40 stuff. And I guess eventually we got BET in our house and
changed your life.
Yeah, it turned me into a thug.
You discovered Nas,
the thug you see today.
Yeah.
But anyway, I didn't just do that for music. I would record wrestling that way, and so like the height of my obsession, and it was almost like a sickness at one point where like I would record Raw. Or any type of wrestling content I would see on TV. I recorded an old TKO once.
Oh, really?
Like, just because, like, I thought this stuff looked cool. I had, like, tapes of, like UWFI back when it aired on
and TSN. Yeah, me too.
And I would...
What did TKO air on?
TSN.
On TSN?
UCC. UCC.
Oh, UCC. Right. That's right. That's right. They did air it.
And anyway, I thought it was just cool and looked kind of like wrestling. But anyway, I would record these, and I had two VHS decks hooked up. And I would make like compilation tapes of like my favorite moments from the week.
That's not weird.
It's so sad. But I
took my friend Paul's VCR for like a year, and I used to I tried to just make VHS like compilations of like all the shit I had, where it was like, okay, I don't really need Invasion of the Body Slammers 92 for a 3-hour tape when there's like a match on there with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels that I would want to save, whereas Earthquake and Typhoon's tag title defense against the Beverly Brothers, I don't really care about.
Totally. And so, yeah, I this would be like a weekly routine for me, where I'd tape like a 2-hour Raw and then tape like a SmackDown, and I would like watch the shows and I'd be like, oh, that segment was great, or that match was great. I'm going to make a note of it. Then I'm going to go back and... I didn't have much female attention at that age.
I wish I knew you in high school. I would have hung out with you all the time.
We would have been great friends.
You would have been my saving grace.
Anyway.
I had zero friends that were into this in my high school.
So I would boil that into like a good copy tape. But you know what? It's funny though, because I suppose like all that, it was almost like sort of a precursor to what ultimately ended up becoming a career for me. In video editing and I guess talking about wrestling and podcasts like this. So it actually kind of worked out.
Wow. Well, that's quite the story. Very curious about that.
I've actually recorded like episodes of The Law too.
In like 2001, 2002, I used to record The Law all the time, because I always thought, I usually listen when I was like going to sleep way back when it started at 1 a.m. I was like, I'm probably going to fall asleep, and I'd record it and then just catch it the next morning. I like invented podcasting. You listen to something the next morning on a cassette tape. Yeah. And I still have probably tons of old shows of The Law somewhere in my storage area of just cassette tapes.
I feel like we're doing our 5th anniversary show before.
Surprise!
It's 2 weeks ahead.
One other thing I want to share with you, Wei. It was a story that I've wanted to get off my chest. I was so angry.
Okay.
Last week, I was coming home from jiu-jitsu, and I'm driving towards my place, and I'm passing, and it's like there's a two... I'm going down this straight street, and someone's waiting at a stop sign to turn left. And for whatever reason, as I'm approaching this like T in the road, I slow down and I look over at this car, and there's this woman. I can see her mouth the words, "Why are you stopping?" And I felt kind of embarrassed. Like, why am I stopping? And I just proceeded to go on, and I went to go give her the finger, and I was like, no, don't. It's not nice. That was just my reaction, was to give her the finger for how dare you. I caught you trying to insult me to your friend in the car. But then I drive away, and I'm like, that was very weird on my part. Why did I just stop?
Well, explain again.
Okay, I'm going down a straight street, and there's an intersection.
Yeah.
So they are at kind of – we form a T.
Okay.
And they're waiting to turn left.
Yeah.
And as I'm going and I have the right of way, I slowed down.
Uh-huh.
And then she was annoyed because she just wants to get going. So I keep driving.
Okay.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, so you were like at a stop sign, like a three-way stop sign.
No, it was just...
Oh, it wasn't a stop sign. She was at a stop sign?
She was at a stop sign.
And you slowed down thinking that it was a stop sign, but it actually you had the right of way. You were supposed to go. Okay. So well, you just had a brain fart, I'd assume.
That's what I told myself. Those were the exact words. I must have just had a brain fart.
And then she yelled at you for that?
I could see her in the window yelling, like with her hands, "Why are you stopping?"
I think it's always unnecessary to be that upset over, I don't know. That sounds to me like a very minor traffic.
Very stupid.
Thing that anybody could be guilty of.
But I was annoyed for the next like 10 minutes.
I would be. Anytime somebody yells at you, that's, but however, maybe you could only assume that she had a bad day, or perhaps just maybe she had a terrible childhood,
and the latter.
It's affected her daily existence.
So. Well, we fast forward a few days, and I'm coming home the exact same way, and this incident is in my head as I'm thinking again, like, why did I stop there? And as I approach, there was a stop sign there, and I was following the law subconsciously.
Okay.
So she had no reason to be upset at me. I stopped at a stop sign.
Yeah, okay.
So fuck her.
Yeah.
I was right.
Are you sure she was upset at that? Maybe she was yelling at you.
I swear, it's clear as day. heard her saying, "Why are you stopping?" as she's pointing at me.
Oh, shit. You should wait at that intersection.
So why don't you take a fucking look to see that there's a stop sign there, and had I not stopped, I might have ran right into you.
That's right.
You moron.
Yeah.
You idiot. Revoke her license immediately. She's a danger to every single person on the road. So if you were in downtown Toronto.
So you regret not giving her the finger?
Kind of. I kind of did, because she totally had it coming.
Mm-hmm.
She fucked up, not me.
It's always err on the side of caution and give people the finger.
She's going to go on. She probably has told that story to 15 people by now about this idiot. This idiot who stopped in the middle of a street.
She's probably on her.
When in fact, she's the idiot. So I want to let everyone out there know, because I know more than 15 people are listening to this. She was the idiot.
Maybe she has her own podcast.
Bring it on.
Number one.
Whatever her podcast is. HowNotToFuckingDrive.com. Subscribe on iTunes. Leave us some feedback.
Yeah, well, I do find that people often feel like because they're encased in some
box
with wheels that they're not subject to the rules of good behavior. You know, I feel like anytime a car is involved, people have, and I'm guilty of this too. Sometimes it can be very stressful driving.
You're a pretty good driver most of the time.
Yeah, thanks. But
there was one time you nearly did run someone over when I was with you in the car. But other than that, I can't think of any.
Yeah, I feel like that happens occasionally.
Have you ever been in a car accident yourself? Driving?
You know what? I have.
Oh, you have?
Yeah. Like just very minor. Like
your fault or theirs?
It was slippery. Yeah, it was. There's a lot of snow on the ground. It was like kind of icy, and I just slid at a stop sign, and it was just a minor kind of fender thing.
Oh, you hit a stop sign, not a car. You did hit a car.
Hit a bumper. Yeah.
Yeah. Bumper.
Yeah.
Everyone's hit a bumper.
Yeah, but nothing major.
Well, that's good.
I don't even feel right talking about that.
Yeah. Do you have any update on Suge Knight?
No. You tell me.
I don't know much.
No. Nope.
He was shot at the VMA pre-party.
Well.
It's pretty nuts that a guy could get shot 6 times and it looks like he's going to recover.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it's been a while, though, since we've heard those stories of rappers getting shot up multiple times.
Yeah. It used to be,
I guess, like 50 Cent. He was shot a number of times. He shot, yes, like 9 times or something.
I think so.
I have to wonder if, like, who has the record for being shot at most times and surviving and going on to a successful rap career?
What rapper
has been shot the most?
I don't even have to type it out. It comes up as an option. Has been shot the most. History of rappers getting shot and surviving. Who do you think it is? It's got to be. My money's on Suge.
I mean, are we talking number of bullets lifetime?
I don't know, incidents versus bullets.
Okay. It's hard to imagine somebody taking more than 9 bullets and surviving.
Oh, come on, what's going on here?
But
this website is giving me
a seizure. I think it's either the fact that rappers are, they, first of all, it's either the fact that they like to exaggerate how many times they've been shot, which is probably the most likely. Secondly, it could be that they're just somehow just very fit. Or it could just be that the people that are shooting them are just terrible shots. And just, I don't know, shoot the worst areas imaginable. Have you found an answer?
Well, this one website is not very good here.
Okay.
10 rappers who got shot and survived from hiphopwired.com.
Mm-hmm.
See, these are all these scrolling slideshow sites.
No, this is not very good radio. It's not even very good in real life.
The Game. October 1st, 2001, while he was at an apartment, he heard a knock at the door at 2 in the morning.
And?
Never answered the door. Cameron, October the 23rd of 2005.
No.
Uh-huh. Well, while he was leaving a nightclub in Washington, D.C.,
okay.
Obi Trice.
Yeah.
New Year's Eve 2005. Shot twice while driving on the Lodge Expressway by Wyoming Avenue in Detroit. One of the bullets entered his head. Trice was able to drive off the expressway where his girlfriend waved down the police. That's pretty nuts. Shot in the head and got off the highway.
Did he signal?
I think he'd be given a pass.
You think he stopped at the stop sign?
Well, he was on the highway, so he was probably... Yeah. Timbaland. When he was 15 in 1986, he was shot during a robbery and was partially paralyzed for 9 months. He was doing work as a DJ and held a series of menial jobs, including washing dishes at a Red Lobster.
I think we should stop, because I think this is a...
We're only on page 5 of 11.
No. Well, because I think this is glorifying the aspect of getting shot at in hip-hop.
Fine. We'll skip Young Dro.
And it's also taking too long, quite frankly.
It is. It's a very slow internet in here. Are you excited about Russell War?
I actually
am. Were you excited about Russell War going into this?
Like you mean in 1992?
No, I mean within the last 24 hours when you probably started and finished this.
That is true. Was I excited going into it? I'd say I was kind of neutral. I really wasn't. Some weeks I kind of dread the reviews because I know the type of show I'm going to watch. This I was actually kind of looking forward to because I knew that the main event was at least highly regarded by many as one of the best matches in the company's history.
Yeah, I think we need to balance things out more of good stuff we watch. I find that's more of a motivation. Mm-hmm. You see, I went away this past weekend, so I came home on Sunday, and I watched 21 fights in a row from the UFC.
That's crazy.
And then I had to watch Russell War.
Oh, boy.
So it was a packed day. Thankfully, I did get through half of Russell War before I went away, because there was no way I was going to watch all 3 hours.
Oh, yeah. We talked about it Monday.
Never mind. Remember?
Okay. Yeah, I do.
So Russell War, 1992, Sunday, May the 17th of that year from Jacksonville, Florida. This was a big change in WCW because the week leading into this, they had just announced that Bill Watts was coming back to essentially head up WCW. He was replacing Kip Fry, who would be moved over and then eventually just completely leave. So this was one of many turnovers of somebody running WCW, from Jim Herd to Kip Fry. Now we were moving to Bill Watts, who at this time in 1992, it was very much there were people that were very excited about Bill Watts running this company, akin to if Paul Heyman was announced that he's going to be running WWE Creative. It's like, man, really? This guy did such great stuff in Mid-South, but that was quite a while ago at this point. He hadn't done anything in the industry in 5 years, so there was a big time gap there. And maybe Heyman isn't the best example because Heyman has still been involved in pro wrestling, but if you imagine if ECW went out of business in 2001 and Heyman was not working in wrestling for 5 years, and then in 2006 all of a sudden he's brought in by WWE to run creative. Hmm. That's kind of how the reaction was, that this is a wrestling guy who can come in and make some much-needed changes to WCW at the time, who were losing money at this point. There were a lot of high-priced contracts as well that Kip Fry had given out, that Bill Watts would have to come in and cut a lot of these costs. But, man, you look at this roster way, like watching this show, this felt almost like TNA, where the company sure wasn't on fire, but they had a really good roster of guys. Mm-hmm. Like Definitely. Sting, Rick Rude, Bobby Eaton, Steve Austin, Brian mm-hmm. Pillman. I mean, the list goes on and on. Some really, really talented performers.
Yeah, and some of those names you mentioned, you know, like a Steve Austin or Brian Pillman, obviously, you know, they weren't really names. They were just starting off at the time. But certainly if you just look at the raw talent that's on this show, maybe like Big Josh aside.
Well, and the Super Invader.
And the Super Invader aside.
Hercules.
You know, it's just, a lot of Hall of Famers on this show.
And a lot of not Hall of Famers.
Yeah.
We'll go through them all. Tony Schiavone and Eric Bischoff open up the show, where they are seated on these director's chairs, and they explain the War Games rules. And how it'll be Sting's squadron against the Dangerous Alliance, which was very heavily profiled in the Paul Heyman documentary, and hence our review this week. Sting is coming back from a rib injury, and then they throw it to the commentators for the evening, Jim Ross and Jesse Ventura. Jesse with his snakeskin coat, giant shades, and a rat tail.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, someone was ready for 1992.
I don't know if that was even a look at 1992. I think that was just him. I didn't see many rat tails, you know, on the streets in 1992.
This man, what a look. This guy would be the governor.
Yeah.
6 years after this.
What is he? What's his hair like now? Is he just bald?
I think he's got a skullet.
Okay. I don't know if he would have been elected looking like this. But, I mean, when you're a wrestler, you got to look, stand out, right?
He stood out.
Yeah.
What did you think of this?
I just Google image searched Jesse Ventura, and he looks so weird now with, you're right, a skullet and no mustache. It's like young on the face, but old on the back.
Yeah, Jesse Ventura's gone down a weird path in life. Very heavy on the conspiracy theories and...
Well, not many people can claim to have been, you know, both a pro wrestler and a governor.
Yeah. So it's kind of amazing this man became governor, especially today's iteration of Jesse Ventura.
And an actor.
What did you think of this format where you kind of had, like, the hosts and then you had the ringside announcers? This was something WCW would use a lot of. It almost just felt like we didn't need both.
Probably
I thought
not.
Eric Bischoff was just... horrendous in this
role.
Yeah,
they're kind of redundant, you know, to have both of them. I suppose they just wanted to put more people at work, to work.
And Jim Ross was going to get a major promotion as well with Bill Watts coming in, where he would be in charge of a lot of things. And then Bill Watts wouldn't last a year in WCW. And once Watts was out, Jim Ross was out too. Mm. And that would lead to Tony Schiavone getting kind of back to that main position. Because if you remember, Schiavone, who had been the voice of the NWA for so many years, then left 1 year for the WWF when Jim Ross was really being one of the featured announcers. And when he came back, he kind of had this limbo role with – you had two, I thought, very good play-by-play announcers in Jim Ross. And I thought Tony Schiavone, very underrated as a play-by-play announcer.
Mm-hmm.
And you had these two guys, but just not enough roles for all of them, at least on a pay-per-view format. You could spread them out on television, but on pay-per-view, Schiavone's role was pretty – unnecessary on this show.
I loved hearing Jim Ross on this because, I mean, I think he excels definitely at, you know, adding drama and adding emotion to a straightforward wrestling match. I think he's, you know, he does really well, of course, with like all the gimmicky stuff too, but I think he really shines, and I think he'll say that his favorite stuff is probably when wrestling is taken seriously. And this, you look at this show in 1992, and I just think about what the equivalent was at the time in the WWE, where characters were a lot more colorful, maybe a lot more gimmicky, and the less focus was put on sort of a realistic in-ring competition. I think this was the perfect product for him to call.
I thought Jesse Ventura was also very good on this show. I mean, his WCW run is largely not splendid. Let's just put it that way. I mean, he had more off nights than on, but I thought he was very good on this show. Him and Jim Ross, Notorious, didn't get along with one another, but I thought they did have chemistry, and this show provided that. Jesse also notes how in discussing war games, he knows all about war because he went to war in Vietnam.
Yep, the same thing.
This is, you know.
Maybe he served alongside Todd. What's his name? Todd Champion.
In
the WCW Special Forces.
We will get into some of the absolute shitty gimmicks of WCW in 1992. Oh, and maybe kicking things off with the tailor-made man, Terry Taylor.
Boom.
Holy shit, this guy couldn't buy a good gimmick to save him.
Yeah, poor guy.
Like, the tailor-made man.
They took a bad pun and turned it into a man's identity. You know?
Thank God you didn't work in WCW.
I would be answering phones.
He's always late. He's always late.
The man who's always late. Oh, no, the man who... the man who always arrives early, because then I would actually be waiting.
Oh, that's right. And then you'd have a love interest. And then when she reveals that she's pregnant, she would say, I'm late.
What? I'm late.
Her monthly cycle.
I know. Oh, okay.
She's pregnant with your child.
All right. Can we
restart?
Yeah, can sure. we erase at least this portion of the
I would
podcast?
Love to. I would love to restart, but our levels just look beautiful from here. I can't give up now.
Okay.
The TaylorMade Man is teaming up with Greg Valentine.
Who
in 1992.
Yeah.
This man at one time was a very good performer.
Yeah,
very,
well, what do you mean? In 1992, I would say he... When did he actually retire?
1992.
Oh, really?
No.
No.
He's still working to this
day. Okay, there you go. So I would say this was probably, in comparison, a very young...
I thought you said when he should have retired.
No. Well, this was, in comparison, I'd say a pretty young Greg Valentine.
I think after 1989, this guy was just always old.
He's kind of this.
Also, the subject of my most depressing interview I've ever done with a man. Well, do you remember at WrestleMania 28?
Yeah, I do. When he basically kind of used the airtime to complain about,
"Where's our money, Vince? I'm broke."
Uh huh.
Sad picture.
I feel like you've had more depressing interviews.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Who comes to mind?
I don't want to name names.
I do.
Okay, let me think. Depressing. No. Let's not do that. I'll have to sit down and think about it.
Okay. You come up with a top 10. Maybe a slideshow. So it's the TaylorMade Man and Greg the Hammer Valentine defending the United States tag team titles against Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin, the least impressive iteration of the Fabulous Freebirds. The TaylorMade Man and Greg Valentine come out to this Eye of the Tiger knockoff theme, which seemed very similar to the theme that Sting's Squadron would also come out to later in the show together. And Taylor had this like Frankie Kazarian-like ponytail.
Okay.
It's TaylorMade.
Ponytail, otherwise known as.
Yeah, a ponytail.
Yeah.
A TaylorMade ponytail. Bill Alfonso is our referee. You could argue this guy would have the most success of anyone in this ring in the 90s.
I don't know. On air, perhaps.
On air.
I mean, Terry Taylor's managed to be employed in pro wrestling, you know.
I'm saying in front of the camera. Michael Hayes, clearly a major power broker in the WWF.
Mm-hmm.
Hayes is dancing at the start. The crowd was very into this at the beginning. Hayes kind of, to me, looked like if Chris Jericho all of a sudden aged a lot and didn't update his gimmick and like stopped working out consistently.
Yeah,
and had some issues on the road, he would look like Michael Hayes. A lot of ifs there.
I could see that.
They worked the left arm of Valentine and then the arm of Taylor with these quick tags. Taylor gets back body dropped into the ring off the ramp by Hayes. Valentine comes in, runs into the boot of Jimmy Garvin, does the flop spot. All four are suddenly in the ring when Taylor hits Michael Hayes with the 5-iron.
Which is?
A punch.
The 5-iron.
The 5-iron.
Yep.
And then Hayes goes for the DDT, but Valentine gets a near fall. Valentine is then attacking the leg of Hayes, tries for the figure four, gets it, but then Garvin stomps, breaks that up. Hayes drops Taylor with a left hand, makes the hot tag to Garvin, who hits a double clothesline to Taylor and Valentine. Valentine trips him to the floor, and then Garvin goes for the DDT, and as he's setting up for it, Valentine runs at him, gets back body dropped, and then hit by Hayes with a left hand. Garvin hits the DDT to the TaylorMade Man and pins him at an ungodly 16 minutes. Long match.
I liked it, though. I mean, no, I don't think it was great. But I think for me, part of it was just watching this match of this era for the first time in a long time. I think it's been a while since we've done a show, like you know, at least from WCW from this point. So I wouldn't say it was great, but
I liked how they built around the DDT. The crowd was, man, it didn't take a lot for them to really get into things.
Definitely. And, you know, I said earlier, you think about what the WWF largely had in 1992, kind of big, burly guys in colorful outfits, you know, doing short, terrible brawling style matches. And in comparison, you could see from a match like this that WCW is clearly more of a workers' organization where, you know, not the, like I said, the match wasn't really great, but the presentation and the style seem a lot more realistic and old fashioned. Longer matches, less gimmicks, average looking physiques. And there are many average looking physiques in this.
Match was okay. I just thought it dragged a little for me in the middle. Schiavone and Bischoff react to the match. Bischoff cites guts and determination for Hayes and Garvin winning the United States tag team titles. Up next was Johnny B. Badd taking on Young Pistol Tracy. And in the graphic, it was the word Tracy that was in quotations. Young Pistol Tracy.
Young Pistol is the real name. Tracy is the nickname.
Tracy, take it or leave it.
He was born Young Pistol, although he's earned the nickname Tracy.
This was Tracy Smothers, who I don't know of all the words used to describe Tracy. I don't know if Young has ever been one of them.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I'd only really seen much of his work from ECW. And, you know, obviously at that point he was already kind of old, but...
He was in his 30s at this point, early 30s, okay, but well, still just does not look young.
To watch him, even in 1992, there's just something about him. Like, he's always had this old man's posture, you know? Like, the way he walks and wrestles, he looks like an old, grumpy bus driver.
Sure.
Like you know, remember Uncle Leo from Seinfeld?
Yeah.
It's like he reminds me of Uncle Leo.
Dominic DiNucci.
Exactly. Yes.
Johnny B. Badd comes out, and of course, doing the Little Richard gimmick. These women are putting money into his knee pad.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
hey. A stripper.
Cost-cutting mode. Good gimmick to have.
That is
Johnny
true.
B. Badd.
Yeah. So what's the deal with that? He got the gimmick because he looked like Little Richard?
That was kind of the influence. It was Little Richard.
Because he just happened to look like him.
I guess that was the way they went. Okay. Isn't it amazing that if you put this character, Johnny B. Badd, next to Brock Lesnar,
yeah,
and what they have in common is the same wife.
Well, tastes change.
So
he rocked it, though, I thought, you know.
Hey, man, he played this gimmick very, very well.
He made it work. This was definitely a gimmick that stood out.
Mark Merrill gets a lot of criticism from people. Mainly because he got a really good contract when he went to the WWF. And you know what? He wasn't a horrendous worker, especially in WCW. Some of the matches he had with Diamond Dallas Page, the guy got over. He wasn't a main event star, but he wasn't a washout either.
I'm just thinking about the
Brock,
the stable, the Brock Lesnar thing.
Ventura's complaining about the closed fist punch of one Johnny B. Badd, which is hilarious because this is Jim Ross's biggest pet peeve every week he brings up on his podcast. Guys using closed fists in matches. This was Ventura's big axe to grind 22 years ago.
Well, what exactly does that mean, though? What's an open fist?
You're not supposed to
punch with a closed fist.
That's why guys use forearms or elbows.
Can I use like a loosely?
You can open and slap the guy. Yeah.
I can't, like...
Closed fist is not... there was a time that was an illegal strike in professional wrestling rules.
In Pancras, they didn't allow closed fist.
Exactly.
So
that was a real wrestling organization.
So at least Jim Ross's ideal pro wrestling would be a wrestling where only slaps and elbows...
Well, his argument is sound. It's the idea that...
It exposes.
If you had these more rigid rules, then when a heel breaks that rule, there's more heat to it when a guy does it. If a behind the ref's back, he hits him with a fist and you sell it big.
See,
but you laugh because that's so ridiculous
in today's wrestling. I laugh because where does it end? Why not impose even more rules and say no hitting at all? Turn it into jiu-jitsu. How big of a deal would it be if all of a sudden, Rafael Mendez in the middle of a match got up and punched a dude? Oh, yeah, it'd be huge.
Well, so, this isn't jiu-jitsu, though.
What I'm saying is, where does it end? You know, like, where do you stop putting limitations on pro wrestling simply to result in, you know, a bigger reaction when somebody breaks the rules?
It's just a closed fist rule. I think you could there's never a bad way to impose certain things. I just think the audience is so far removed from that it would be very hard to move backwards at this point.
And I also feel like, I mean... I think we're at a point where people don't mind the fact that wrestling is fake. We just, you know, we like it for what it is. And kids aren't really necessarily the ones to make the connection that, oh, how come he's not bleeding since he's being punched in the face anyway? So, I mean, it's just, to me, it's just not that big of a deal to have a closed fist.
In New Japan, closed fist gets heat.
Really?
When a guy clocks someone right in the jaw.
So how do they punch?
Elbows, forearms.
They just don't punch.
No, it's very rare.
Really?
And they did a few spots in the G1 where a guy just clocked him, and it was considered, I think it was Shibata who did it, and it was like a bullshit move for this shooter to just sucker punch a guy with a closed fist, and the crowd gasped at this move. And I thought it was really cool because that crowd is educated that these are the parameters of which you work in, and that's considered dirty.
I will say, certain guys now, and even on this show, a lot of guys had closed fists as their finishers. You know, like the Big Show, for instance. He's sort of a different case because he's so large, but like it would certainly help. You know, guys like that. You know, otherwise you're watching and you're thinking, why is this punch any more powerful than the others?
So the match begins as Ventura continues this rant. He puts over the fact that a loss by either one of these men will set them back a year in the rankings for that junior heavyweight championship. So they're big odds here.
Waste.
A year. There is a jumping sidekick by Smothers, and then a reverse elbow off the top, gets a two count, then a reverse cross off the top. Ventura is breaking down the rear chin lock and how you properly apply it by putting three quarters of your weight onto him so that he has to carry three quarters of your body weight with this chin lock applied from behind. That's science there.
I suppose.
The art of... Look at this. Robin Black breakdown here.
That's right.
Rear chin lock.
Mm-hmm.
There is a flying knee by Johnny B. Badd. Ventura continues to complain about all of these illegal tactics, such as the closed fists, yanking him by the hair. Then Badd ducks a sidekick, catches him with a left hand, and pins him 7 minutes and 3 seconds, sending young Pistol Tracy a year into a tailspin. And Ventura, disgusted, and compares that punch to a chair shot. I love Ventura during this match.
He's okay.
No, too annoying.
He was a little much, I thought. I mean, at least in contrast to Jim Ross, who was super strict and like kind of, you know, almost maybe.
The issue is he makes too much sense that if you're rooting on the babyface, you want Jim Ross to defend the babyface here, or else the babyface is just cheating, as Ventura is pointing out.
And I'm sure that was like sort of their agreed style, you know, hey, Jesse, actually bring
Ventura
up.
Would always do that with Gorilla Monsoon. A Gorilla would never have a great comeback for the babyface.
Yeah. Yeah, like, they're definitely, Jesse brought up a lot of interesting points, but they were, I felt detrimental to the overall product at times.
Missy Hyatt's backstage with the Freebirds, and Precious, who is the legitimate wife of Jimmy Garvin, and says how she is the woman behind the Freebirds, and Hayes dedicates this to Lynyrd Skynyrd and says they are climbing that stairway back to heaven. Now they're going for the tag titles, the actual tag titles, not these U.S. dinky pieces of shit. And this would actually be, I believe, Precious's only live appearance at an event.
Really?
One and done. And I think she did some vignettes with them, and that was about it. So it was very... very brief she was here. Wasn't even out at ringside with them, so it was kind of a disconnect. And then when they went back to Ventura, he ripped on Hayes for confusing Stairway to Heaven as a Lynyrd Skynyrd song. Bischoff notes that in today's politically correct world, there is a successful... Behind every successful man is a successful woman, in reference to Precious. And then we went to our next up... Scotty Flamingo, the future Raven, taking on Marcus Alexander Bagwell, the future Gigolo.
Who knew both men's...
The guy named Scotty Flamingo would not become the Gigolo. How about that?
Well, yeah, like, I mean, just seeing these two in this current incarnation where, you know, they're both very fresh-faced and young and, you know, kind of innocent-looking, to be honest with you. Who knew one would turn into this very dark... persona in a hardcore wrestling federation, and the other would
be Raven.
No, I was gonna say turn into a dark another type of hardcore company.
Hey, you were you hung out with Buff Bagwell recently.
I did not hang out with
him. What did you guys do?
We were there was a comic book store had a little convention where they brought in a number of kind of famous athletes and, you know, UFC fighters and wrestlers. And among the wrestlers that were there were Kevin Nash, Scott Steiner, Buff Bagwell.
Should have interviewed them about Wrestle War.
And Coco Beware.
Coco Beware.
Coco Beware, of course, was there too. And also Virgil.
Of course.
Rare appearance by Virgil.
Did he say anything?
Well, he was standing and walking. There was no booth.
Oh.
So.
Out of his element.
I had a camera there. I was just shooting B-roll. We weren't doing it. We did interviews with the fighters, the UFC fighters, not the wrestlers. He seemed a little camera shy, Virgil.
Virgil?
Yeah.
Well, it's been quite a few decades since he's had one in front of him.
No, I wouldn't say so. I think people take photos of him all the time. He's
not a camera, though.
Just might not be aware of it.
Not live action.
Anyway, Buff Bagwell was there and, you know, looked to be in high spirits, smiling
buff.
A lot. Yeah, I think so. He's in porn now. There's no hiding.
He hasn't officially done porn yet.
Oh, he hasn't?
He hasn't officially.
But he signed a contract.
I'm not up on my latest Buff Bagwell news,
okay.
So maybe he has.
All right.
Wonder what his first film will be called. That's always the only part I care about. What will the title be? The Cockbuster?
Buff Bagwell.
That's it.
You like that one?
That was American Male.
Yes, that's it.
Buff Bagwell.
Yeah.
I need a moment to compose myself. That was really good. Somehow during the beginning of this match, Ventura brought things back to Vietnam and on live pay-per-view called Jim Ross a coward for avoiding the draft, hiding in high school when he went to Nam.
Awesome.
Holy shit.
Why not? And like, I just imagine what was going through Jim Ross's mind the moment this is uttered.
This son of a bitch!
Guarantee you, like,
fuck.
Ross is just freaking out on the inside, but he's trying to keep professional. He can't say a thing.
Fuck, called him a coward for avoiding the draft, hiding in high school. Ventura legit says that he bets these two get a ton of women on the road, or at least highly hinted at it.
Sure.
There were slaps back and forth. Bagwell got sent to the floor, brought back in. Flamingo had the heat. What a stupid name. There's a running cross body. Both go over the top to the floor. Bagwell starts a comeback back in the ring. He hits the Fisherman Buster suplex called the Yellow Jacket Suplex. What?
Okay.
Sounds like an exhibitionist. And then Flamingo gets a rope break. There's an O'Connor roll reversal, and Flamingo rolls him up, grabbing the tights, and pins Bagwell at 7 minutes and 9 seconds. No word on what this would do to his ranking over the next year.
Yeah, this wasn't bad. I thought it was actually really interesting to see these two so young because they would kind of go on to become more famous, you know, under different kind of slightly altered personas. But to see them at this young age, I thought they actually moved really well. I found their styles a lot more fluid and technical than later on in their careers, especially Buff, who I don't remember kind of wrestling in this style in the late 90s.
Buff Bagwell, second place on the Putski Award list for this show.
Oh, okay.
Number one to be revealed.
Yes, yes.
I think a shoe-in. Then we got an awesome promo for Beach Blast coming up on Saturday, June the 20th, a Saturday night pay-per-view.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back to the beach. WCW Beach Blast. This summer, beat the heat with a barrage of buff bods and bodacious babes, because WCW's cruising through the party down on the Gulf Coast. We're talking a sizzling slam fest, one huge scene, a mega rager. It's totally featured. WCW Beach Blast. Beat the heat live. Saturday, June 20th. Be there only on pay-per-view. Call your local cable operator for availability.
The copy of this pay-per-view promo included the words Bobods and Babettes. Totally beachin'.
It's totally beachin'. Love it.
God, it was like this company, if there was a major fault, it's that it reeked of 55-year-old white guys trying to appeal to young people.
I like it's totally beachin'.
Totally beachin'.
You son of a beach, actually, was a TV show.
That was the Howard Stern show,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
They had a recap of Junkyard Dog storming the ring to save Ron Simmons at Super Brawl after Abdullah the Butcher and Cactus Jack were double-teaming Simmons. And this featured JYD doing the run-in while wearing a white dress shirt, a red bow tie, and jeans.
Uh-oh.
What a look.
Red bow tie and jeans?
Red bow tie, white dress shirt, jeans.
It's whatever you could pick up in the closet.
And that was to set up our tag match involving Cactus Jack and Mr. Hughes taking on Ron Simmons and the Junkyard Dog. Whew. Jack sneak attacks JYD as he's walking down the ramp, and they fight by the ramp, and Junkyard Dog gets sent ribs first into the to the ramp, and then Jack hits a flying elbow off of it. Simmons then backdrops Jack on the ramp. JYD is selling his ribs. He needs help, and Ross says that he may have punctured a lung. And just a huge collection.
Well, it's amazing, his biological ability to analyze potential injury just from
X-ray vision
like that. Yeah.
Jim Ross.
I can see from a distance at the entrance.
He may have punctured his lung. Yeah. huge collection of mullets here tending to JYD as he's helped to the back. And then Simmons returns and attacks them alone with a double clothesline. Cactus Jack was just making these crazy shrieking sounds. And then there just felt to be this big confusion amongst the announcers of what was going on, whether this was going to be a handicap match with Simmons against both Cactus Jack and Mr. Hughes. Was this going to be a singles match? And the worst possible option was what actually happened, a singles match between Ron Simmons and Mr. Hughes.
The two people I wanted to see the least of before.
Cactus Jack just served as, like, the second at ringside. Like, what a waste.
Yeah.
The most talented guy in this, the whole thing, is the guy that's just standing there on the floor.
I kind of, I wanted to, well, Jay, I assume that was the match that they were ultimately building to. Because, I mean, those two, at least JYD seemed like one of the central figures in the whole thing. And he was taken out early.
Actually, during the beginning of this match, Jesse Ventura brings up the name Bill Watts and asks Jim Ross, do you remember that guy? And Ross responds, vaguely. That was funny.
Mr. Hughes actually wrestles with his sunglasses on.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He's been doing that his whole career.
I'm amazed at the runs this guy got. I mean, after this run in WCW, he would go to the WWF. Then years later, he got a job as Chris Jericho's bodyguard.
Yeah. He's like the de facto bodyguard.
He is the bodyguard figure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like his... He actually, the sunglasses are like strapped on, and they're so tight. I think they're permanently indented into a groove in his skull.
Yeah, he's like, who's the guy on Star Trek?
Geordi.
Geordi, that's who I'm thinking of.
Yeah, although he's, yeah, sure.
He is the Geordi of professional wrestling. Okay. Curtis Hughes.
Yes.
Simmons, what happens here? Hughes has the advantage. Simmons hit a sunset flip for a two count. Jack is attacking him behind the referee's back. Simmons makes a comeback. Back body drop, spine buster. He hits Jack with a shoulder block and then runs at Hughes with the three-point stance, sending him off balance and pins him 5.5 minutes. A pretty dreadful match. Ventura complains about this as well, saying it was an illegal clip. This would not fly in football. Not football. Mm.
So that's that.
This match sucked. Shivani and Bischoff put over Cactus Jack's attack onto JYD, called it a frightening situation when Jack attacked him off the ramp with an elbow drop. And then the real main event of the first half of the show was next. Todd Champion against a super invader who was Hercules Hernandez under a mask.
Yeah, under a mask. Yet another Asian gimmick.
Clearly, for a white man.
Clearly portrayed by a white guy. Super Invader is built from Bangkok, Thailand, and he's just this guy. I mean, think of Hercules. You know, think of his stature. They put him in a singlet.
His gimmick was a multicolored glove.
And a red mask, like just a plain red-colored mask with like a Japanese rising sun headband on it. And so, I mean, he's from Thailand. Why is he wearing a Japanese sun...
Asia, you know.
But they just, I just love the thinking, though. Hey, shit, we need some foreigners on our roster.
It was tough, though. Jesse Ventura, he had to spread out his Asian stereotypes between this and the later tag match with Tatsumi Fujinami and Iizuka.
But just the idea that you, of all the people on your roster to choose to play an Asian gimmick.
Hercules.
Yeah, he looks Asian enough, this guy.
Like, the guy you would only sign because people would have been familiar with him during his WWF run or prior to that. Let's put him under a mask. So we're going to be paying this guy based on his name and hide who he is. Uh-huh. Like, you could have grabbed a guy out of their power plant system and put a mask on him.
I could only imagine that this was maybe temporary.
This guy, had a, he was there for a year.
As the Super Invader.
Yeah.
Oh, God. He, like...
And I thought Ric Flair being paired with The Miz sounded stupid. Harley Race being put with Super Invader was up there. Like, what a waste of Harley Race.
He also had this, like, black yarn coming out of the back of his mask. Like, I don't know if that was kind of their attempt at making straight hair, like Asian hair.
Yeah.
But this, it just looked like yarn. It looked like thick yarn. This is so bad. But
was this which was the worst gimmick of the two, though? Because that's
it's
very
tough
close.
Because you had Super Invader built from Bangkok, Thailand, and then you had Todd Champion, who was built from the WCW Special Forces.
So WCW has earmarked money each year to fighting on the world stage against terrorists.
Whose freedoms are they protecting? The wrestlers?
All of ours.
In case there's ever like a Iraq WCW war, Saddam wants
get it. Wants the to Monday take- Night War. Had it become literal with that tank showing up in Norfolk, maybe they would have needed a Todd Champion to fight.
From the WCW Special Forces. I wonder if that whose creation we have to thank.
Old white men running creative.
There's a lot of old white men came up with great ideas, too.
That's true. This wasn't one of them, or two of them. This did lead Jim Ross to mention that, I can't imagine spending a night in Bangkok. I was waiting for Jesse to say, the world would have been your oyster had you done that. I mean, you ever heard of that song?
Mm.
One Night in Bangkok?
Oh, no, I didn't know the lyrics, though. No. Sorry.
I'm an old white guy. The Invader's offense consisted of punches, a choke, a reverse chin lock where he didn't put three quarters of his weight onto his opponent, and then Champion gets kicked off the apron into a guardrail. There is a scoop slam on the floor. The Invader then comes off the turnbuckle into a boot. Champion makes a comeback. Champion screws up some spot, reverses an elbow, and then gets dropped on the top rope and takes a powerbomb as Invader gets the win at 5:27. I just wrote bad match.
You know, anytime we watch one of these old WCW shows, they have a number of kind of matches that they know people are paying to see, and then the mid-card is pretty much just stuffed with meaningless filler, jobber type of matches, and this was definitely one of those. Just, I thought for a second we would have had like a nice, you know, a potential gem on this podcast in a match like this, but it wasn't even interesting.
No, this was not even a good, like, on TV this would have been bad.
Yeah.
Ross and Ventura preview the War Games. They push that the lineup for Beach Blast will be made this week on WCW programming. And then we had Richard Morton taking on Big Josh, described as the likable outdoorsman.
Well, last time, for those of you who remember, less than Big Josh appeared on this podcast. He had come out with two live bears.
Oh, I was not here that time, but this became a legendary promo.
This actually became a clip that we clipped out. So he arrived here, sans bears, but still in full flannel and overalls. And an axe. Didn't he have an axe?
He did have an axe. And I had an axe to grind after this match. Richard Morton, who to this day, young talent is told, if you are studying a baby face and how to act, you watch your Rock and Roll Express tapes and watch Ricky Morton and his one of the most legendary babyface comebacks ever. So we're going to turn him heel. And how are we going to turn him heel? He's no longer going by the fun-loving name of Ricky. He's now Richard. Because he's a dick.
So if you were to turn heel,
Jonathan Pollock.
Sorry.
This was the idea that where people are going to boo this man because he's no longer Ricky.
Richard.
He's Richard.
Well, I mean, they
what a stupid idea.
I know. Well, they did Stevie Richards, Steven Richards.
What would your name be? Is way short for anything?
Like my full name, but I don't think
it... Oh, Wei Chung.
Yeah, but I don't think it sounds any different in...
It does sound heelish when Gordon says it all the time.
That's true, yeah.
He never calls Wei by just that name. It's always full. No, never ignores the hyphen.
Yeah, that's it.
So Richard Morton and Big Josh. Someone thought this would just be a great, great collision on pay-per-view. Ventura says that Big Josh only showers once a month, and therefore his clothes may be the difference in this match.
The whole match, he was harping on his hygiene.
At one point, Richard Morton is laying down on his back, and Big Josh stands on him and starts running. It's called the log roll.
Yeah. That's his big spot.
I lost it during this fucking spot.
It was so
long.
It was so stupid, John. It's so dumb. But it gave the audience some reaction.
Oh,
you know, the audience at least was able to point it out, and they're like, "Oh my god! Oh, it's the log roll."
Morton came back and he tore Josh's flannel shirt off. Morton then put pressure on the left arm.
When he tore his shirt, this was the best part of Jesse's commentating. He was able to derive an analysis of Big Josh's hygiene by noticing how easily his flannel shirt ripped. He says, "Oh, flannel! It rips so that rips so easily. It must not have been washed in weeks." I don't even know if that's true. Like, I don't even know that if that
it would harden, wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
Nice plaid shirt.
Yeah, I love the pants. You can tell they've been washed a lot. Once a month, whether they need it or not, right?
Not traditional wrestling footwear either, but it has been approved by WCW. Running knee lift by Richard Morton. High impact move. And he's ripping that flannel shirt right off the back of Big Josh.
And that shows you right there how rotten those clothes are if they'll rip that easily, Jim Ross. Flannel like that means it ain't been washed in months.
So Josh finally takes the whole shirt off. The crowd's dead. There's a belly-to-belly by Josh, a double underhook suplex for two. And then, and I quote from Jim Ross, Big Josh yells timber and hits Northern Exposure, which sounds like a woman flashing somebody.
Or a man.
And then appears, and then Alfonso.
The move, by the way, is the earthquake splash. He runs the ropes and sits on the guy.
That is the Northern Exposure.
But why wouldn't it be Southern if he's sitting down on the guy?
Maybe it was considered too taboo to say Southern Exposure. It'd be too off-putting. So Bill Alfonso then fucks up the three count. He doesn't even count three. And the match is called at 7.5 minutes. Oh, this was god-awful bad.
This is another filler match.
Just goofy, goofy stuff.
And a double axe handle by Big Josh. Big Josh yells timber. And here goes a Northern Exposure. He got him with it. And the power of Big Josh, too much for Morton in this contest.
Wait, did he? Yeah, he did get up.
Then we had the big build-up to the match. Not between Brian Pillman and Tom Zenk. It was Flying Brian and the Z-Man.
For a second, I heard Jim Ross say C-Man earlier in the broadcast, and I did a double take. Because a number of Tom Zenks would have been
maybe that's a
taboo.
A future ally would be coming to watch his back, the C-Man.
The Z-Man?
The corner man. Z-Man.
I mean, that could be Buff Bagwell.
They had a video here where Pillman gets upset at Z-Man because Z-Man is overlooking him and already making challenges of who he'll defend the title against before he's even won it from Flying Brian. And this the fashion here of these two, just beautiful.
I love it. I love the mullets on this
early
show.
90s.
Yeah.
I loved it. Flying Brian against the Z-Man for the light heavyweight title. Which is so off-putting for me because this was like their cruiserweight title. But when I hear light heavyweight, I think the second largest weight class.
It is.
I guess so. I guess you had heavyweights and light heavyweights in WCW.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't think of small guys. But when you think about it, John Jones would have been fighting for the cruiserweight title.
Well, what exactly is the limit in WCW?
Wasn't it always 225 pounds? At least that's what it was for the cruiserweight title.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't even.
Cain Velasquez would barely be heavyweight in WCW.
But Frank Mir, I think he could make it.
To what, cruiserweight?
Yeah. How much is he?
He was at one point 265. He did get a little bit smaller.
Okay. I thought he was one of the smaller heavyweights.
No, he had
who's
some.
Who's a heavyweight at like 225?
Well, Velasquez is like 235.
Oh, okay.
240.
Well, Kane could definitely cut.
If he put his mind to it.
Could have been the cruiserweight champion.
Him and Ultimo Dragon.
Yeah.
That could have been great. Him and Eddie Guerrero.
They would have totally buried him on with the Luchadors.
God, imagine them.
In the LWO.
Brown Pride tattoo. What kind of gimmick they would have come up for with him.
Wow.
All right, so the match begins. They shake hands, but Zenk pulls his hand away. Pillman goes for the left arm early. They play up the fact that they have teamed together. They know each other so well, and they can telegraph each other's moves. Pillman hits a flying head scissors, grounds him, and then grabs the arm. It eventually escalates to chops. They're going back and forth. I thought Jim Ross did a very good job here explaining the fact that Brian Pillman has back problems, and Z-Man is now targeting the back. Drops his knee on the lower back. Pillman had a half crab. Z-Man then misses with a knee into the corner. Pillman applies a figure four. Then they slap each other back and forth. This was like right out of Frank Shamrock, Boss Rutan in Pancrase. But this was before they did it, where they're just slapping each other back and forth from the figure four position.
Mm-hmm.
Pillman then slingshots him into a power slam by Z-Man for a two count. There was a crucifix by Pillman for a near fall. Leapfrog is made by Z-Man, and then this weird collision as they both went down. Fans were popping for the near falls. And then Z-Man gets the big boot up as Pillman comes off the top, puts his foot on the rope, and then goes for this jumping kick off the top and misses with that. And Pillman catches him with a jackknife cover. 15 and a half minutes between these two, and Brian Pillman retains the light heavyweight title.
I thought this was a good, dramatic, back-and-forth battle. Nice match.
It was fine. Didn't blow me away. Very different style. If you were expecting a cruiserweight match, this wasn't really any high-flying. They were doing very much a kind of just regular kind of mat-based style throughout this match. But it was good. I liked it. Next up was a number one contenders match for the IWGP tag titles with the Steiner brothers taking on Takayuki Iizuka, who would later just become Takashi Iizuka, completely unrecognizable from his current form to this in 1992.
Is he still wrestling?
Oh, yeah. He still wrestles.
Where?
In New Japan.
Oh, wow.
He comes down. Yeah. He's the old prick who always attacks the play-by-play announcer, handcuffs him, tears his shirt off, paints his chest, and all these puts like Hello Kitty images on him and stuff. He's not a very good wrestler in 2014, but he's a gimmick. Teaming with Tatsumi Fujinami. So Fujinami, and talk about different looking. I mean, not only Iizuka, but Scott Steiner.
Oh, my God.
If you were to put these two together, God, it takes like you got to really look back and forth to realize these are the same person.
Not just in the way he looks, but certainly in the way he wrestles, too. I mean, to me, I watched Scott Steiner in this incarnation, and he's somebody who might as well not exist anymore. I saw him recently at that comic convention, and not for a second do I recall that guy being the same as this one.
He wasn't lifting up anyone and doing fall-away slams with backflips?
No, he wasn't doing that. You see Scott Steiner and you think about the guy with the muscles and the high-pitched, kind of slightly annoying voice doing push-ups.
Percentages of winning.
Yeah. You don't think about the agile amateur wrestler with the long, flowing brown mullet that we see.
Yeah, he was really a tremendous in-ring talent, especially at this point in his career. Fujinami and Scott start off. Ventura brings up the Japanese car companies putting their car workers out of business, with the Steiners being from Detroit.
Yeah, and then JR just perfectly, dryly shuts him down and says, those editorial comments by Jesse the Body Ventura, fireman's carry takedown from Scott Steiner. He just moves on.
He would also add, though, later in the match,
well, I got to tell you one thing. You may love it, Japanese, you may hate them, whatever your choice is. That's your prerogative, fans, but you got to respect them. This kid has taken a battering and a hammering, and he has not quit. He has continued to try to turn. He's continued to try to move to his corner and make the tag.
Got to respect those Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Scott goes for this fall-away slam backflip. It doesn't hit it on Fujinami, but then does it to Iizuka.
It was like a moonsault slam.
This was like part of Scott's repertoire at the time, and is nuts when you think about it.
It was a moonsault slam. You sometimes see guys do it off of like the second rope, but this guy, he would do it standing.
Like, this was crazy.
And, you know, I'm sure he was able to hit it at a high percentage. The first time he did it, though, in this match, he basically
killed Fujinami.
He landed on the back of his own head, rolling on his neck. So, needless to say, I can't imagine him doing that today.
Probably not. Though, remember in TNA a few years ago, he did a top rope Hurricane Rana. Frankensteiner.
Don't you ever call it a Hurricane Rana.
Crowd is chanting USA. Scott bridges out of a jackknife cover, hits a double underhook suplex. Rick comes in with an elbow drop off the top as Scott is holding Iizuka up in like the San Martino-style backbreaker maneuver and busts open the nose of Iizuka. Rick is then on the shoulders of Fujinami, who hits a Iizuka comes off and hits a top rope cross body, but Rick reverses it in midair and lands on top. Just some insane stuff for the time.
From Rick, too, not just Scott.
Fujinami then is applying, hitting him with leg kicks and submissions to Rick. The Steiners are then working over Iizuka, as Ross is putting over the fact that this will be making headlines in Japan tomorrow. There's a pump handle slam by Scott to Iizuka. Scott then applies a body lock as Iizuka tags Fujinami in. Rick then comes in. They're all brawling. Eventually, he's tagged in legally. The Steiners are using their amateur slams and holds. And then Scott hits a double arm drag to both men. Steiner line is hit by Rick. And then a spiked pile driver is hit to Scott. Fujinami then applies a dragon sleeper. They get the rope break. All four are in the ring. And it ends with Rick hitting a belly-to-belly suplex off the top to pin Iizuka, who was largely there to take the fall. But really solid tag match, I thought.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I thought the Steiners were just, they displayed a lot of very nice technical takedowns and suplexes. And, you know, I think it's clear to see that these two, it's no wonder that they mesh so well with the Japanese style, because they're not just big, powerful brawlers, at least at this time. I mean, they're very technical guys. I was just constantly amazed by the agility of Scott Steiner here, moving like a cruiserweight at times.
Yeah, so great stuff there from both here.
I thought Jim Ross did a good job of conveying the legendary status of Fujinami as well. You know, putting over kind of his technical wrestling mastery. I thought he was great the whole show.
Next up, Ross and Ventura start previewing War Games. Jesse Ventura's description was just great. He says, "You've got the minute intervals, or whatever they are." He had no clue. So thankfully, Ross was there to explain the rules more in depth. We go to Schiavone and Bischoff. They say the match is too close to call. Thanks for the cutaway. Bischoff says, "What if their will to win is overcome by their instinct to survive as individuals?" What?
Okay.
Gary Michael Capetta introduces the match, says, "Let the War Games begin," as we get one of the saddest pyro displays in pro wrestling history, with a few shots being fired and then some pyro above the ring.
Well, I mean, they had two rings. You know, they had only so much budget.
To me, it's like, if you can't have a great-looking pyro display, just don't do it.
You're also thinking about it from, you know, 2014 standards of pyro. At the time, I don't know how elaborate pyro was always in WCW.
Wow. The Dangerous Alliance against Sting's Squadron was our main event in the War Games.
You know, and the thing, obviously, about the War Games is just even the visual spectacle of just seeing the two rings and then on top of that, two giant cages around the whole thing, I thought was enough to kind of get the crowd excited and to make people interested in a match like this.
Yeah, and I mean, War Games had been a real protected gimmick in the NWA and WCW. So this was, War Games was typically looked at as a big deal because there would be a big clean finish. It'd be a violent match. And, I mean, this totally delivered in that regard.
A lot of legends in this match.
Yeah, we had, you know, just running through the teams here, we had Sting's squadron, which consisted of Sting, Nikita Koloff, and then Ricky Steamboat, Dustin Rhodes, and Barry Windham taking on the dangerous alliance of Steve Austin, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, Bobby Eaton, and Larry Zbysko, with Paul Heyman and Medusa in the corner of the dangerous alliance. So, yeah, a ton of stars in this particular match. So we got a long list of rules. I believe 9 of them that they ran through at the beginning of the match. Made it sound more complicated than it really is.
I skipped all that stuff. I mean, it's basically two men start, coin toss.
A 5-minute period, and then every 2 minutes, a new guy enters. Match can't end until all 10 men are in. Simple.
And it's a submission finish.
Submission or surrender.
Or surrender, yeah.
Steve Austin and Barry Windham start the match with Austin throwing into the second ring and into the cage face first. There's a DDT to Austin. Crowd was just so hot during this match, and Austin started bleeding right away during this first period, and my God, did he have color throughout this match. Huge juice here from Austin, and Windham bites the opened up forehead. Oh God, there are things in wrestling I don't need to see welcomed back, this being right at the top of the list. Jesus, did you hear that? Feel that? The lights just went off. The lights just went out, and then they went back on.
No, I blinked.
Oh. You blinked, and the lights go out and right back on as you open them.
Yeah.
That's like some X-Men shit. All right.
Okay, well, all right.
We had the world's fastest coin toss as the first period ends with the heels winning the numbers advantage. Imagine that.
Wow, what a surprise.
Yep. In the history of these kinds of matches, it was only a Vince Russo-booked Lethal Lockdown where the baby faces once had the numbers advantage.
You gotta be realistic.
Of course. Bro. So Rick Rude is next in, who already won on tonight's evening.
Oh, okay.
The much valued Scott Putski Award.
You know, I would definitely put a Super Invader up there. I'd even put Todd Champion up there.
Bagwell was certainly in the mix. There were a few on this show. Believe me,
okay,
there were
I'll
Rick Rude, though, was to me another level. Congratulations. He comes in, attacks Windham, and then they're double-teaming him. You know what I love so much about this? You know when the heels had the heat? Whenever they had the numbers advantage.
Oh, yeah.
It all... Dude. Like, what a basic match to lay out.
So basic. Basically, any time a baby face came in, you had a hot tag set up. That was a big comeback.
And then when the numbers were not in their favor, they got beaten down for 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it created a huge reaction when you had a baby face run in to even it out.
Yep.
This is such an easy match to lay out, but was great. Ricky Steamboat was then next in. Crowd explodes as he evens it up. Hits DDTs to Rude and Austin. Just a massive reaction. Delivers a Hurricane Rana to Rick Rude. Then Arn Anderson comes in. Hits a DDT to Windham. Spinebuster to Steamboat. And then a double crab to Steamboat by Arn and Rude. Dustin Rhodes then comes in. Fires up on all of the heels. Then Larry Zbysko comes in. And Medusa scales to the top of the cage, runs across, and drops Paulie's cell phone into the ring so Arn Anderson can get it. And then Sting climbs off, chases Medusa off as the heels have the heat. What was most impressive to me was how fast Medusa, A, climbed up the cage and did it without, like, shoes on. You know how painful that would be climbing that fence?
I guess.
That would hurt.
Really?
And she did this quickly. Like, I've seen guys struggle to climb these things.
Well, she's very agile. She's an athlete.
Yeah.
I thought it made for a very impressive visual and surprising because, you know, it made me think about Undertaker and, you know, Shawn and Undertaker and Mankind. But this was obviously years before that.
Fortunately, Medusa would never have a Hell in a Cell match. I think she could have done a lot. Her and Bull Nakano, that's where it should have been. SummerSlam 94.
Wow.
Hell in a Cell.
Can't believe we had Medusa like 2 weeks in, or I guess 2 out of 3.
Yeah. So as Larry Zbysko's in, there's just blood all over the mat here. Sting comes in next. He lifts up Rick Rude and is gorilla pressing him into the top of the cage.
That was great. That was like some Superman shit.
You know, Ross is just selling this huge. They're showing tape. They're taping up Bobby Eaton's right hand on the floor as he gets ready to come in. Sting is rubbing Arn's face into the fence. Ross says, it will take them days to get over this match, if ever. Big extremes. Days or forever. Bobby,
it's like a real war.
Yes.
PTSD.
Bobby Eaton is the final Dangerous Alliance member to enter. Dustin Rhodes all of a sudden is bleeding a ton from the forehead. The Dangerous Alliance, they're trying to loosen the top rope turnbuckle. Nikita Koloff is the final entrant, and then the match beyond begins, where, as we mentioned, it ends in submission or surrender. And Koloff, who they tease having problems with Sting, helps him to his feet, and then it leads to Koloff moving Sting out of harm's way as he gets taken out by the heels, and then they fight off Arn Anderson and Austin, and then Sting and Koloff hug, and you've never seen a crowd so excited to see two men announce their friendship to the world.
Mm-hmm.
This was just a great moment. The top turnbuckle is now off of its hinge, and Zbyszko, clearly Bram watching his old War Games tapes, Zbyszko grabs the steel part of the turnbuckle, misses Sting and hits Bobby Eaton in the arm, and then Sting applies the armbar that we just saw Mr. Anderson use last week on Sam Shaw in the I Quit match. Same arm lock. And Bobby Eaton, this is clearly TNA booking.
Yeah, they definitely watch this tape.
This is what they watch. And Sting gets Bobby Eaton to quit, and the match ends as Bobby Eaton, the pain he is in from this metal contraption hitting his arm in the arm lock is too much for him. And the Dangerous Alliance are livid at Larry Zbyszko, with the best comment being from Bobby Eaton, who just is holding his arm and says, Zbyszko, Jesus Christ!
I thought this was a great match.
This was an awesome match.
I didn't think there was anything technically amazing or Marvel about it, but it was the pacing.
Oh, and this was just a great, violent brawl for 25 minutes.
And the intensity and the atmosphere. Like, it felt like a mini soccer stadium riot in there by the time everybody was in. I thought just the booking was tremendous, too. A lot of memorable moments throughout. I mean, even Medusa just climbing up that cage, that provided a great visual. All the big reactions the babyfaces got once they came in. The ring rope breaking, I thought, added a lot to the visual of the chaos of the whole thing. It was interesting throughout, and the big crowd reactions really added to the whole thing.
Yeah, just a great, great match. I think everything you want out of these types of matches. I was never a huge fan of these kinds of matches, but this was just such a great match.
If executed well, you know, I'm sure there have been a lot of fumbles, too, in the match's history.
But this was really, really well done. Easily the highlight of the show.
And do you think WWE will ever bring a War Games match?
I don't think so. I think if they would have wanted to do it, they would have done it by now. It's always an option you can do down the road. There's nothing that prohibits them from doing it.
Like, were the concerns about maybe the sizing of the stadium or how the limiting of the seats?
I think it's more just the fact that
it wasn't their creation.
I think it was such an associated with WCW, NWA idea that they just didn't want to.
You don't think they'll ever get over that? You know, this is like 12 years now that
It was pitched at one point to do, and instead they went with the Elimination Chamber. Yeah. Like, they wanted their match.
Which I'm really not. I don't like as much.
There would be some nostalgia for it, but I don't know. I don't know how much it would really be.
I just think it would be something that would really stand out just from the look, you know, to have a pay-per-view where you had two rings at the whole time and then a big steel cage on top of that.
Shivani and Bischoff just end the show plugging Beach Blast. They throw back to Ross and Ventura. Ventura calls it the most brutal pay-per-view event he has ever called, which does describe some of the middle of the card. And then they sign off and we get the credit roll, including Bill Watts, executive producer. So that was Wrestle War. What a wide range of reactions on this particular show. But an excellent War Games match. I give this show a 7.5 out of 10. Especially the last two matches were really, really solid, I thought, especially War Games.
Yeah, the last match, I definitely encourage people to watch. I mean, I feel like in promotion of this network, instead of just plugging $9.99 all the time, why not make a little kind of
this week in history?
Yeah, or like a, what, like an NFL Films type of thing. You know, you have all the guys there. You have you know, access to Steve Austin. You have Arn Anderson right there, and you know, do a little kind of look back at, you know, the, exactly this day in history. This historical match took place, and you can watch it right now on this fucking thing. Because how else would a kid who's never heard of War Games or you know, Wrestle War 92, why would he ever stumble on to watch a match like this without some education? You have so much great stuff, but people have no incentive to go and find it if they don't know about it or they're not put into a present-day context. So I would love to see
We might have done more promotion for the network
guaranteed.
Than they did on Raw Monday.
Oh, guaranteed.
So Wrestle War 92. You can watch it on the network, though not in Canada. You cannot watch this on the network. Have you gotten the network in Canada?
No, not yet.
No. Not in a hurry to do so either.
Oh, I make do. I'm fine right now.
Well, there you go. That was our look back at Wrestle War 92. You know, the real success of this show was the fact that when this ended, I kind of wanted to watch Beach Blast after. I was like, I wanted to see where the next TV would go and kind of, because I was not watching WCW at this point in time. I don't think we even got it in Canada. So, and I would have been about 8 years old at this time. So was not following it week to week at this point. But this was a really, really fun main event.
We got something way better than Beach Blast.
Oh, we're going to top Beach Blast, believe me, when we announce what we're reviewing next week.
Yeah.
All right. But we're going to chat with you, the listener, now with your feedback. Martin starts off from London. I found Wrestle War 92 to be somewhat unbalanced, with the best three matches all at the end. Pretty primitive presentation with the constant cutaways to Schiavone and Bischoff with his notes on his lap, and the only backstage segment featuring Missy Hyatt and with the Freebirds and Precious. The Freebirds and Valentine Taylor went way too long and could have done without the false comeback in the middle. Always enjoy seeing Tracy Smothers considering his antics on the indies. Other than Cactus Jack's attack on JYD, not much else going on except a look at an early Buff Bagwell and Raven. I got an AJ Page frenemies vibe from Pillman and Zenk, and they had a very good match with nice storytelling for a light heavyweight title match. I really enjoyed the Steiners against Fujinami and Iizuka, or how stiff and violent it was. Incredible to think that the young man in electric pink trunks grew up to become this strange man wandering amongst the fans in New Japan and beating up the announcers. And as for War Games, what else could be said about it? It's the greatest War Games match of all time, filled with blood, hatred, Sting and Koloff making up, and Paulie dangerously losing his mind at ringside. Yeah, Heyman also had these giant, like, blueprint.
He had notes.
Notes, yeah. Like their strategy, as if he was building a house. Yeah. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. He gives this show 7. What the hell is a super invader out of 10?
We go to the fact checker himself, Chris in Ottawa. He says, hey guys, I'm sure you enjoyed the whole show as much as I did. The rockabilly babyface Freebirds were a big pile of shit compared to the dirty redneck stars and bars Freebirds, but they had a great opening match. Interesting to see that the WWE got their special event panel idea from Wrestle War 92. Teen idol Eric Bischoff and child actor Tony Schiavone really added to this one. The tag match near the end of the night gave us a chance to see how rice and fish stack up against meat and potatoes in WCW. Quite frankly, I'm just glad the poor Japanese team survived. What a ridiculous exhibition in near quadriplegia and smash faces that was. A great main event, though. All sorts of unique psychology. Several Hall of Famers. Barry Windham biting Steve Austin's bloody forehead. This had something for everyone.
All right, next up we go to David Duffenberg. This was a very interesting show, mainly because the undercard was pretty awful and the last three matches were so damn good. The ending of that Big Josh match was so bad it was hilarious. My 6-year-old was even confused by it and kept asking me why the match ended. That must have been the first sign for Bill Alfonso to make the switch to managing. The opener was far too long. Super Invader was a waste of time. The Steiners were very entertaining. Injuries and an overabundance of muscle mass sure did drag those two down. And of course there was War Games. I've always been a fan of the gimmick, even though the rules make the first 15 minutes inconsequential. If the performers make it feel like an important match, it was one hell of a treat. This was one of the last War Games that felt important. Seeing Paul E. talking strategy outside the cage was classic and just added to the big match feel. Overall, I give this show 7.5 out of 10. The first 90 minutes of the show kept this from being a real top-notch show.
Matt in suburban Detroit With all due respect to the train wreck 99/2000 WCW, this train wreck era was amazing. Sandwiched in between two lousy War Games matches was this gem. You'd think after Sid nearly killed Pillman, the roof would have been elevated. But no, not much talent in that match. Made seem larger than life. By good old JR. So weird to see Double A in the cage first. Ari Gold, Jeremy Piven, Paul E. being showcased for his managing.
Next up, Skull Captain. When you originally announced this week's review, I thought you had already done it, but then I realized I had actually seen this War Games main event on the DVD that WWE put out last year. I remember these times well, as the only wrestling I had access to at the time was the WCW Worldwide show, because I didn't have a satellite system, which WWF shows were on. The lower mid card was very uninspiring despite some good talent, but the top three matches really lived up and even exceeded expectations. The light heavyweight title match was good, the tag match was better, and the War Games match was probably the last great one WCW ever presented. Both of the teams were packed with great wrestlers and they excelled in this match concept. I have to say that if you wonder why everyone says Paul Heyman is one of the best managers ever, here is the proof from his early Dangerous incarnation. His proper paper plan, the constant chatter, and the great facials were a marvel to watch. I knew that some have wondered which female performer should go into the Hall of Fame next, but I would certainly like it to be Medusa. I know that the Nitro belt binning would probably be a big black mark, but I think that she still should have that kind of recognition, and let's be honest, who else is really deserving more than her?
We go to Brad from Halifax, who says, cons of the show. The light heavyweight matches were very disappointing. It was not the light heavyweight action that we could come to see in the 90s and seemed a lot more like the smaller guys wrestling heavyweight slow styles. Not much excitement for this style of match. Pros. The commentary of Jesse the Body and Jim Ross was amazing. These two have great chemistry, and I love the fact that Jesse would always side with the heels and make up excuses for their failures or justify their means. These two might be better than any pair of commentators on TV today.
And finally, another Brad, this one from Whitby, Ontario. This is my first feedback, so please indulge me as I give a quick recap of my review away experience before I get to Wrestle War. I started listening in May of 2014, and after listening to my first show, Hardcore Heaven 2000, I felt it was my duty to go back and start review away from the beginning. Currently, I'm through about 230 episodes. My personal favorite has been WrestleMania 5. I wasn't watching wrestling at this time, so most of these characters are new to me. I can't believe how much I enjoyed Jim Ross and Jesse Ventura calling this show, with Ross playing the straight man, technical wrestling announcer, and Ventura playing the heel, always on Ross's back. The simple fact that they tried to work in logical explanations for every wrestler, his moves, and mindsets really made me interested in most of these matches, but I couldn't stand the format of match, toss to Tony and Eric, toss back to the ring, and repeat. I found it very humorous to see my WWE live events pitchman, Doc Hendricks, wrestling in the Freebirds. I'm well aware of the Freebirds' history, but to me, Michael Hayes will always be Doc Hendricks telling me when the next time the WWE is coming to Oshawa. Seeing Mark Marrow's Johnny B. Badd really freaked me out, but he had the line of the night during his entrance with, "Let's not sit down, let's get down." Was it just me, or did anyone else think a young Buff Bagwell looked like Disco Inferno? The hair and pants made Judy's son a dead ringer for Disco and a Scott Putski nominee. I didn't know that WCW had a special forces unit. How is Champion able to get away with having the Olympic rings on his pants? I believe the IOC would be suing the pants off this guy nowadays. My favorite match of the card had to be Big Josh and Richard Morton. The commentary from Jesse on Josh's dirty clothing was hysterical. Scott Steiner's hair was glorious. And in the War Games match, I can't believe the amount of blood we saw. At least half of the guys were busted open. The absolute low point of the whole card was Barry Windham biting Austin's face after he was covered in blood. Fucking gross. Austin sold that bite, though, as well as everything else in this match. I understand that Zbyszko accidentally hit Eaton in the arm with that rod from the turnbuckle, but Sting uses an armbar to win? Really? I would have to give Wrestle War 7 feet of toilet paper out of 10. I'm a huge fan of all your stuff. Thank you. All right, well, thank you, Brad, and thanks to everyone for your feedback this week at a very polarizing show of Wrestle War. Good and bad on this show, good as was bad. The case in WCW at good. This time period.
It's a good slice of what was there at the time.
All right, So that's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Review Away. And next week, we're not reviewing Beach Blast, but boy, do we have something in store for everyone. We are going off the rails to review a show that is available to everybody online, a very easy to find show, and that is Juggalo Championship Wrestling. Are you ready, Wei? Are you going to be down with the clowns next week as we review Bloody Mania 6?
What?
Bloody Mania 6, featuring the likes of Matt Hardy, John Morrison, and the Juggalos on commentary.
What?
2 hours. How long is this fucking show? 2.5 hours. I can't wait.
Bloody Mania 6?
At the Gathering of the Juggalos. A very easy to find video on YouTube. Simply type in Bloody Mania 6. And I think we're in for a treat next week.
Did somebody request this?
Nope. I found it.
This is going to be great.
This is going to be something else.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you Bill Watts was not booking Juggalo Championship Wrestling.
And I love ICP on commentary.
So that is going to be coming up next week. This might not be everyone's cup of tea, but it's going to be ours next week.
I guarantee you it's nobody's cup of tea, but that's why it'll make for an interesting review. How many views does this video even have?
9,432 and counting. So we will post this up on the feedback thread. So if you get through this, leave some feedback. Maybe this will be a great show. Who knows? I'm looking forward to it.
Don't even need the WWE Network.
Different is good. I like different. Yeah. This isn't going to be on the network anytime soon.
You don't think they'll acquire the rights to the Juggalo Championship Wrestling catalog?
Ship. They're legit now.
Oh,
it's
okay,
not shit anymore. So that's coming up next week. Maybe some future content on the network. Maybe Fight Pass will grab this. Scoop it away from them.
Mm-hmm. The Ultimate Fighting Championship.
a great knockoff, potentially.
Yeah.
So that will be our big review for next week. And then in 2 weeks' time, it's the anniversary show where we will take your questions. We're going to open it up, do something different with the feedback. I don't know what we're going to do. Are we going to announce the review ahead of time? Because we won't be taking... You decide over the next week if it'll
be... No, we'll take... We could take... You don't think we'll take feedback for that?
Well, you were saying you wanted to take questions. You want to do both?
I guess, oh man, yeah, that'd be hard.
You got to think this stuff out. You're the head of logistics.
You know what? We won't take feedback. Let's ease up on the feedback for 1 week.
Okay. So it's questions on anniversary show.
Yeah. Only feedback about our lives.
Yeah. And only positive, of course. Okay. So next week, it's Bloody Mania 6. 2 weeks from now, the anniversary show. So there you go. Lots of stuff coming up in the world of Review Away. How should we end this show, Wei? How do we put a cap on Wrestle War 2? Wrestle War 92.
92. Well, Wrestle War? War? 1992? The big war of 1992? You know that one? Is that big war?
You know what I'd love to hear? Do you remember who won the World Series in 1992?
Of course.
The Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah.
Do you remember that Coke ad during the commercials?
I was thinking the same thing.
That's what I think of when I think of 1992 songs.
I actually had thought of that before you even mentioned the Toronto Blue Jays.
That's crazy.
Always Coca-Cola.
Let's make sure.
The rap? Yeah, do you know... I think this might have been 93, but actually in 93, they had like a rap right after they won the first commercial.
Oh, right. It was 93.
Right after they won, after Carter hit that home run, the commercial they ran was like a version of that.
And it was customized.
Coke rap. Yeah, with the names of the players.
Okay, well, I want to make sure I can find the Blue Jays version.
We got to look for the Coke.
It's no longer 1992, so it's not relevant. Here we go. Coca-Cola salutes the 1993 World Series champions, the Toronto Blue Jays. A year and a half after Wrestle War 92, this was released.
The original Coke rap.
And everyone in Toronto, and Canada for that matter, remembers this. And now you will have the luxury of hearing this too. We will chat with you next week. We're proud of our Blue Jays. When the finish-
Remember.